The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for hosting this event. It's really my honor to be here with my friend Anthony LaPay. He truly is a guerrilla reporter, and it's great to be here with you also, Anthony. I've been traveling around the country for about a month now, giving talks at various places not so unlike this. But I've spent my life in community activism and community media. And people like us don't often end up on CNN or MSNBC or Fox or any of those networks. But last fall, I did have an opportunity to find myself at the table for a brief moment in time because of the conduct of Blackwater. And I'll sort of tell you a funny backstory to this. On September 16th, 2007, I was actually at kind of a raging party with some friends. And I remember I'd done an event at the Brooklyn Book Festival that morning, and I was commenting to a colleague, you know, now I can finally figure out what I'm going to do with my life, because, you know, for like the past year, my life was sort of like being John Malkovich, except it was Blackwater. It was Blackwater, 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 that scene where John Cusack walks in and Malkovich, Malkovich, Malkovich. Anyway, guess you'd have to be there. So I'm at this party, and it went late into the night on September 16th, and I was talking it up to people like, oh, now I can figure out what I'm actually going to do with my life and a new, you know, a different story. And the next morning, I woke up to my phone buzzing, and I had missed like 23 calls, and a number of them were from my friend Sharif Abdelkaddous at Democracy Now. And some of them were from a number I didn't recognize, a 212 number. And I called Sharif, and I was like, what the heck is going on, man? I had like a massive hangover. And Sharif's like, oh, CNN has been calling all morning for you. And I was like, what's CNN? I thought I was still dreaming, and I didn't know if it was a dream or a nightmare. And he's like, yeah. He's like, did you hear what happened? And I said, no. And he's like, well, Blackwater just shot a bunch of Iraqis. So I called CNN back, and they said, oh, we want to send a car for you. We want you on the air right away. So I'm scrambling to try to figure out what had happened. I take out the ratty suit I had at the time, which I had bought in Jordan, when I was over there. It's like had holes in the elbow. And I'm on my way to CNN, and what was clear to me before I even got there was that, you know, obviously a huge development had happened in the Blackwater story, but that the producers at CNN, like, Googled Blackwater, and the thing that came up was that somebody somewhere wrote a book about them. So they didn't bother to look at who that somebody was. They just said, get the Blackwater guy here. So I end up in the CNN studio at noon, and that was, at the time, the noon hour on CNN was simultaneously broadcast on CNN Domestic and CNN International, so it went all over the world. And, you know, they put the makeup on, I sit down in the chair, they put the little thing in my ear, and next thing I know, I'm on. And at the beginning of the interview, the host on CNN was sort of asking me very technical questions about Blackwater and the operations of these companies. And then as we got into it, which was clear that's what they wanted me to talk about, as we got into it, though, the host says to me, sort of understatement of the year, you sound like you're critical of these companies, you know? Yes. And he said, So what would the alternative be? Now, I know what he wanted me to say, or what he thought the answer would be. He wanted me to say something like, well, I think we shouldn't be using these private forces. I think the military should do this. But instead, I decided to answer the question that I think he should have asked me, which was, what is the alternative to occupying Iraq? And so I said, well, I think that the United States should withdraw all military forces from Iraq and bring their mercenaries and contractors with them. Not exactly the answer he was looking for. And I thought for certain, you know, the interview was going to end there. But it didn't. And I'm not sure if it was because he was a little bit stunned, because that doesn't get said on CNN, or if he just was going to let me keep going. And so I said, and I also think that the United States government should pay reparations to the Iraqi people for the damage that has been wrought on that country. And I thought for certain the interview was going to end there. And this time he definitely, you could see it. His face was just kind of like, okay. And I said, and let me just say this. I think it shows the arrogance of the United States government to believe that it can impose on a civilization that's been in existence for thousands of years, longer than this country, a form of government, and believe that people are just going to accept it because Bush says it's so. And with that, the interview was definitely over. So So, and you know, I thought I wasn't going to end up on any of those shows ever again. But for, you know, a couple of weeks, I was invited regularly. I was at the, you know, their sort of table for a little while. But I took it very seriously, not just on the issue of Blackwater, which is a deadly serious issue, but also, you know, and Anthony knows this too, spending your life in community media, people like us don't have access to those airwaves. And I don't just mean people that are community journalists. I mean people who represent a different way of viewing the world that, in fact, is embraced by most of the world, which is that you don't wage offensive wars. You don't conquer other nations to steal their resources or to redraw maps. And so I tried as much as I could over this period of time to inject some of that analysis, which is embraced by many people in this country, but it's never reflected in the corporate media. But the reason that I was there that day was because of something that was incredibly tragic. And that's the first story that I want to tell tonight. And it did, in fact, take place on the afternoon of September 16th of 2007. A 20-year-old Iraqi medical student named Ahmed Haitham Al-Rubai was driving with his mother, Mahassan, in the family's white Opel sedan in Baghdad, and it was a little bit after noon. And his mother, who was in the passenger seat, was a physician. He was a medical student. The mother was a physician, and they had just dropped off his father, who also was a medical doctor, Dr. Jawad, and they dropped him off at the local hospital where he worked. It was a family of medical professionals. Medicine was in their DNA. And this was a family that had an opportunity to leave Iraq on the eve of the U.S. invasion, but ultimately decided to remain in their country because they felt that more than ever in the history of Iraq during their lifetime, medical professionals were going to be desperately needed as the country braced for this incredible violence that the invasion would bring. And so on this day, when they were driving, they were running errands, they pulled into an intersection in the Mansour district of Baghdad known as Nisr Square. And while they were pulling in, a convoy of heavily armored vehicles was driving in the wrong direction on a one-way street toward them. And the men inside of the armored vehicles saw Ahmed and his mother, Mahassan, in their car and decided that they were potential terrorists or suicide bombers. And so one of the men inside of the armored vehicle, atop the armored vehicle, decided to shoot Ahmed Haitham Al-Rubai in his head and shot him dead in the square. His mother began shrieking, crying out, "My son, help me, my son." And grabbing onto his body. And some Iraqi traffic cops in the area saw this happening, and they ran over, and they describe how they were trying to pull her out of the vehicle, to extract her from the car, but that her grip on her son's body was so tight they couldn't get her out. And they saw the men in the armored vehicle still had their weapons trained on that car, and they feared that they were going to shoot, and the officers put their hands in the air for two reasons, to show that they didn't have any weapons, but also to desperately say, "We want to get this woman out of the car." But then it became clear to them that more shooting was going to happen, and they kind of fled the vehicle, and gunshots rained down on that car, and according to witnesses, it blew up, burning Mahassan inside of the vehicle with her son. Those shots fired at that car began a 15-minute period of sustained gunfire. At the end of it, 17 Iraqi civilians were dead. Many others were wounded. One of the early victims of the shooting that day was a 9-year-old boy named Ali, who was shot in his head as he sat in the back seat of his family's van. And his father, when he was shot, grabbed his body and could still feel his heart beating, and he ran to a hospital in an effort to save his son's life, but his son died. And this boy's father, Mohammed, returned the next day and looked for pieces of his son's skull so that he could put together as much of his body as possible to take it to the Iraqi holy city of Najaf to bury it. Women were killed that day. People were shot in the back as they attempted to flee. You see, the Iraqis didn't know who was doing the shooting. They did what I think many people would do. You run away from gunfire. And some of them survived, some of them didn't. One Iraqi lawyer who was shot four times in the back gave testimony a couple of weeks ago to the United Nations in Geneva. But the men who did the shooting that day at Nisr Square were not members of Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army. They weren't members of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, and they weren't members of the United States Marine Corps. They were private forces deployed to Iraq by a for-profit war corporation, and that company, of course, was Blackwater. Now, what happened after the shooting was well documented. The Iraqi government was under the highly mistaken impression that Nouri al-Maliki is, in fact, the prime minister of Iraq, and that Jalal Talabani is the president of Iraq, and the Iraqi government said, these forces have to leave our country, except the men who did the shooting, they need to remain because we're going to prosecute them in our courts. Now, what became abundantly clear was that Condoleezza Rice is, in fact, the prime minister of Iraq, and George Bush is, in fact, the president of Iraq, because when Rice got on the horn to talk to Nouri al-Maliki, ostensibly to apologize, she read him the riot act and said, "These guys aren't going anywhere. They're too central to the U.S. operations in Iraq." So for 3 days, while this, the fallout was occurring from this and the Iraqis were making these statements, Blackwater's operations did in fact shut down. And when Blackwater's operations shut down in Iraq for those 3 days, no U.S. officials could leave the Green Zone. In the words of an Iraqi friend of mine, they turned the Green Zone into the Green Zoo because all of the U.S. officials were trapped inside of it. But on the fourth day, it almost sounds like a reverse biblical story, on the fourth day, the Blackwater men were on the streets, armed and dangerous once again, and it became a very potent symbol of the utter lack of sovereignty of the Iraqi government. Now, on this issue of we're going to prosecute these guys in our courts, in the Iraqi courts, that's an interesting issue that has played out recently with this so-called status of forces agreement that's being, well, they say negotiated, but negotiation implies two equal sides discussing an issue. There is no equality there. Nouri al-Maliki, when he's told by Bush to jump, he says how high. When he's told to do jumping jacks, he says how many. There's no sovereignty. That's not an actual government. These are people that do not reflect the will of the Iraqi people whatsoever. But the Iraqi government is actually prohibited from prosecuting anyone designated as a private contractor for any crimes whatsoever in the Iraqi court system. And that goes back to the Bremer era. You remember when Paul Bremer was sent into Iraq in 2003. He was guarded by Blackwater on an initial $27 million no-bid contract, and they kept him alive in Iraq for a year. And on his way out the door, well, you see, Bremer also was sort of like the emperor of Iraq. He said in his memoirs, most Iraqis have only known two leaders in their lifetime, me and Saddam Hussein. I don't know that I would have made that comparison if I were Paul Bremer, but when Iraqi journalists made that comparison, Bremer shut down their newspaper, but he then went and wrote it in his memoirs. But the reason I say he was an emperor is because he issued this series of edicts, and on his way out the door in June of 04, he issued a particular edict known as Order 17. And what Order 17 did was to grant a sweeping preemptive immunity to anyone the United States government designated as a private contractor from prosecution in Iraqi courts for any crimes whatsoever, from murder right on down. And he did this at a time, he issued this order at a time when he said he was handing over sovereignty to the Iraqi government. It was a strange definition of sovereignty to defang a country's legal system and then say, oh, but by the way, you're sovereign now and you're independent, have fun. And that law remains the default position on contractors in Iraq to this day. Now, the Iraqis are saying that the U.S. has agreed to change that. I'll believe it when I see it. I'll believe it when I see a Blackwater operative sitting in the same kind of courtroom as Saddam Hussein. It's just not going to happen. There's no question about it. Publicly, what played out after these killings, though, were two primary versions of events, the Blackwater version and the Iraqi government version. The Iraqi government version, of course, was this was an unprovoked slaughter of Iraqi civilians, and everyone who was killed was killed as a result of aggressive offensive action on Blackwater's part. Blackwater's version of events went like this. We were the victims of an armed ambush by enemies and insurgents, and we were nobly defending American lives in a hostile war zone. And furthermore, they said there may have been involvement of the Iraqi police or military in this ambush of the Blackwater convoy. And these two events were floated in the media and played out for a while. And Blackwater was casting aspersions on the Iraqi government's claims, saying the Iraqi Interior Ministry, which is doing the investigation, is a hotbed of sectarianism controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr. We can't believe anything that they say. Now, what they conveniently left out of those allegations was the fact that there were U.S. liaisons working in the Iraqi Interior Ministry. So I guess they were closet members of the Mahdi Army while masquerading as U.S. liaisons there. And while these aspersions were being cast, Blackwater was also saying, we have to wait until the U.S. government does its investigation and people need to stop running off to the races to condemn our men as just sort of senseless killers. And we did, in fact, have a U.S. government investigation that took place right afterwards. The people assigned to investigate the Blackwater shooting at Nisr Square were not law enforcement officials. It wasn't the FBI, which is the top law enforcement agency in the U.S. It was, in fact, people who were being guarded by Blackwater that were tasked with investigating Blackwater, the State Department. So the State Department investigators sit down with these Blackwater guys to take their statements on what happened that day. But they didn't simply, it wasn't an interrogation. These guys weren't read their Miranda rights. You know, if you and I were arrested or questioned in this kind of a crime, we would be read our Miranda rights. We'd be told we have the right to remain silent. Anything we say can and will be used against us in a court of law, if we're lucky. These guys, though, were given something called limited use immunity before they even said anything. And what the limited use immunity said is that nothing that you say to us can and will be used against you in a court of law, and nothing you say can be used to bring criminal charges against you, sort of the opposite of the Miranda rights. To put this in a legal perspective, Limited use immunity is usually offered to people close to the suspects in an effort to get them to say something about the suspects. It is almost never offered to the suspects themselves. There'd be no point in doing that because you're then immunizing them from any future charges, which very well may have been the point. From a historical perspective, this is how Oliver North got off after Iran-Contra. He was given limited use immunity protection in return for his testimony in front of the United States Congress. His lawyers later argued that no charges would have been possible against Oliver North had the government or the prosecutors not used information gleaned from his protected congressional testimony. So this was a very, very serious act that was taken by the Bush administration in the immediate aftermath. One U.S. official, and I talk about this in the updated version of my book, talks about how they circled the wagons, the Bush administration did, around Blackwater to protect them. The second thing that happened is that a few days after this incident, there was a document leaked to the media that purported to be the State Department's what they called first blush report on the incident, the initial findings of the State Department investigation. Now, predictably, it backed up Blackwater's story down to the letter that they were victims of an ambush, etc. The problem with this document, though, is that while it was on State Department stationery and had the stamp of legitimacy of the United States government, it was in fact written by a Blackwater contractor named Darren Hanner and presented to the media as the State Department's version of events. And of course, you know, it took a while for that to come out, but people were saying, oh, well, the State Department is backing up what Blackwater is saying, so it must be legitimate. I mean, maybe many of you wouldn't view it that way, but it, you know, that's sort of how it was playing in the media at the time. But there was another force that arrived on the scene shortly after this shooting, 20 minutes after the last shots were fired, that could not be so easily dismissed as a sectarian organization. That was the United States military. Lieutenant Colonel Mike Tarsa of the 1st Cavalry Division, he and his men were there. And they did what a law enforcement agency should have done. They did a crime scene investigation. They interviewed witnesses. They interviewed survivors. They gathered evidence. And they put together a timeline. And what Lieutenant Colonel Mike Tarsa of the United States military said is that this was, quote, a criminal event that had every indication of excessive shooting. He also documented that people appeared to have been shot in the back as they were fleeing, and that he and his men were shocked at the caliber of weapon that was being used by Blackwater in the square that day. Now, that investigation went almost nowhere. But if U.S. soldiers were accused of being involved with a criminal event of that nature, they would have faced a court-martial under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The men who did this shooting that was labeled by a U.S. military investigation a criminal event walk around to this day free individuals with no charges against them, and they have been immunized by the U.S. State Department. And Mike Tarsa, Lieutenant Colonel Mike Tarsa's investigation, has gone nowhere, and it almost never gets mentioned. It was 2 weeks before the Bush administration deployed the FBI to Baghdad. 2 full weeks. The crime scene was contaminated. The witnesses were gone. But they did go. And when they were preparing to head over to Baghdad, we discovered that they, in fact, were going to be guarded by Blackwater when they went over to investigate Blackwater. And only after Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont raised a ruckus about this did the FBI back down and say, okay, we'll guard ourselves. We won't be guarded by Blackwater when we go to investigate Blackwater. So the FBI goes over there. And after they were there for a while, some of their initial findings were leaked to the media. And federal agents said that 14 of the 17 Iraqis killed that day were killed as a result of unjustified and unprovoked gunfire. The military said that the FBI was being too generous to Blackwater. And now you have a grand jury that's been convened. Maybe a handful of people will go down because of public pressure. But nothing significant is going to happen to the companies that are doing this business in Iraq, and no substantial changes are going to happen within the industry. It's like much of what's happened under the Bush administration. The people lowest in the command structure, the rank and file, they go down. You know, Lindy England and Charles Grainer deserve to be imprisoned for what they did to prisoners at Abu Ghraib, but so do the contractors who were there, and so do Donald Rumsfeld and the generals who made it possible. All of them belong together. Now, it's not that there aren't U.S. laws that could be enforced here. Now, it's complicated. There are big loopholes, but clearly they could be prosecuted under the War Crimes Act. Bush's Justice Department is not going to do that. The military could make an argument that they should be court-martialed under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but that has not happened. The Bush administration does not recognize international law, and the Iraqis have been banned from prosecuting them. This is not an accident of history. This is intentional. It's a necessary part of this system. When you step back and look at the bigger picture, the reality is this. Right now, in Iraq, the United States has 630 corporations on the U.S. government payroll, 630 corporations. with 180,000 personnel. There are only 150,000 U.S. soldiers. There are 180,000 private contractors. Those private contractors come from 100 countries around the world. The United States spends $2.3 billion in taxpayer funds every week occupying Iraq. 40 cents on the dollar goes directly to the war corporations. It's the most radically privatized war in the history of this country. The reasons why the Bush administration uses this system are many. We could spend hours talking about it, but I'll just cite a few. Number one, it keeps a draft off the table. If the Bush administration was not renting this army, it would be absolutely necessary for them to implement a draft, and that would make the occupation untenable because people would not stand for it in this country. People would stand up against it. Number two, it makes it so that international diplomacy is quaint and no longer necessary. You don't have to have a coalition of willing nations. You can have a coalition of billing corporations. You replace international diplomacy with no-bid contracts. You turn the entire world into a huge recruiting ground. Take the example of Chile, the nation of Chile, a country that has been militarily and economically targeted by the United States through the overthrow of Allende and the rise of Pinochet. Chile had a rotating seat on the United Nations Security Council at the time of the invasion. They said no to the war. So we will not send our troops. And so what the Bush administration did was to use Blackwater to go into Chile beginning in late 2003 and recruit and deploy Chilean soldiers in Iraq as a party to a war that their home government was against. Some of the men that Blackwater hired were seasoned veterans of the Pinochet era in Iraq, and they were paid for by U.S. taxpayers. The man who recruited them served in Pinochet's military, the man Blackwater worked with, and I tracked him down and interviewed him for 2.5 hours on the record, and I have a whole chapter in my book about Blackwater's man in Latin America, Jose Miguel Pizarro Ovalle, and tell the story of how they recruited the Chileans as a way of talking about how the whole world is now the recruiting grounds. This is a direct violation of Chile's sovereignty and a threat to the independence of nations around the world. When you have 100 nations with their citizens deployed in a war that many of these governments are against or have declined to participate in, that is a radical subversion of sovereignty of nations across the globe. And that's what's at the heart of this system. If they started prosecuting these individuals for their crimes in Iraq, it would be bad for the war business. And war is business, and business is very good right now for these companies. So that's one of the main reasons why this isn't going to happen. Now, I just told you there are 630 corporations in Iraq. There are 177 companies providing mercenary services, private security services. 177. That's almost as many nations as there are registered at the UN. This has incredible implications for global stability, international relations, and the future, the very future, in fact, of the nation-state structure in the world. It calls into question alliances like NATO and the validity of the United Nations when the services, once the realm of sovereign governments, are now on the open market for bidding. It raises very serious questions about international affairs. I chose to focus on one company, Blackwater, because I believe that this company embodies so much of what we have seen happen, not just under the Bush administration, but really since 1961, when President Eisenhower gave his farewell address, and he talked about the rise of unchecked power within the military-industrial complex. I think it should be required reading of everyone in this country. I go back and I look at it often because Eisenhower was so dead on when he talked about the risk of linking corporate profits to war, because you're building in an incentive for things to get worse and not better. And now you have a situation where it's not just the weapons industry. You see, Eisenhower was just talking about the makers of tanks and bombs and guns and planes. Now you actually have the outsourcing of the actual fighting. And so Ambassador Joseph Wilson says that you have in these companies a very powerful special interest group that is in fact armed. And he said, you know, one of the worst things about mercenaries is that one day they come home. And in this company, Blackwater, you don't just have some publicly traded company that's, you know, negotiating and trying to acquire other divisions or is just interested in stock price. There is no stock price. It's privately owned. It's owned by one man named Eric Prince, who is a major bankroller of right-wing Republican candidates for office, including campaigns of President Bush. But he comes from a family, a very powerful conservative dynasty in the state of Michigan, that bankrolled the rise not only of the Republican Revolution, but of the radical religious right in this country. His family gave the seed money to Gary Bauer to start the Family Research Council. Gary Bauer, of course, one of the original signers of the Project for a New American Century, the neoconservative agenda. They gave money to James Dobson to start Focus on the Family, Prayer Warrior Networks. They are very close to Chuck Colson, Nixon's hatchet man during Watergate, the author of Nixon's Enemies List, who now has remade himself as an evangelical minister and is an advisor to President Bush on his faith-based initiatives. The owner of Blackwater, Eric Prince, is only 38 years old. He also did something that most children of the wealthy don't do. He joined the military. He was in the Navy SEALs for a brief period of time. And his sister, Betsy, is married to Dick DeVos, the heir to the Amway Corporation fortune, the single greatest bankrollers of the Republican Revolution. And these families merged together in the kind of marriages that were common in the monarchies of old Europe, and they have formed a formidable behind-the-scenes power player in radical right-wing politics in this country. And so you now have the reality that a man who is, and I come from a deeply religious family, and so I'm not just throwing this out as rhetoric, a man who is clearly a Christian supremacist with a very narrow definition of Christianity and an interpretation of it. The most violent possible interpretation is the one that Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, embraces. This man now has an armed force that is above the law, deployed armed and dangerous inside of a Muslim country as part of a war that President Bush once called a crusade. To me, this is a very, very grave situation, and it sends an incredibly horrifying message to Muslims around the world. The fact is, though, that while Blackwater was under all of this scrutiny at one point, congressional investigation, Justice Department investigation, the company has continued to be rewarded. In April, Bush extended their contract in Iraq for yet another year. Now, we have an election, obviously, coming up in November. Conventional wisdom would dictate that Barack Obama is going to do something about this and take it on. Now, there's no question that John McCain would be the preferred candidate of Blackwater and the war industry. You know, as I've said, the Republicans could run ahead of lettuce for president, and the head of lettuce would be enthusiastically embraced by the war industry. They talk about head of lettuce is going to keep us safe, and head of lettuce is a patriot. And now they have a candidate who is actually slightly less charismatic than a head of lettuce, but it is what it is. John McCain's top advisor, Charlie Black, who's on the Straight Talk Express with him all the time, was actually a PR consultant for Blackwater, hired by Blackwater to prepare Eric Prince for his testimony in front of Congress last year. So there's no question that it's going to go in that direction. Interestingly, as a caveat to this, for the first time in 15 years, the war industry is giving more money to Democratic candidates than Republicans because they see which way the wind is blowing. They want to, you know, maintain their relevance. But the enthusiasm would much more be for John McCain. They just want to make sure that they're relevant. Obama, though, is complicated. You know, there's no question that Obama has been a leader on this issue in the sense that he saw the problem well before anyone else paid attention to it in the Congress. He introduced legislation 8 months before Nisr Square. I've been critical of his legislation, but Obama understands this issue. The problem, though, is that Barack Obama's policies will bring more business to these companies because Obama does not actually have a plan to end the occupation of Iraq. He has a plan to downsize it and rename it. He intends to keep a force of somewhere between 20 and 80,000 U.S. troops in Iraq after he's done withdrawing. He's going to keep in place the Green Zone, the monstrous U.S. embassy that was built in part on slave labor, maintain control of Baghdad International Airport, and to keep in place what he calls a strike force to strike at al-Qaeda. He also, his senior foreign policy advisor, told me on the record that Obama cannot and will not rule out using Blackwater and other private security companies, and he will not sign on to Representative Jan Schakowsky's legislation seeking to ban the use of these companies. And the reason is because he can't with his Iraq plan. It would be untenable. Unless Barack Obama radically changes his Iraq plan, he is going to continue working with these companies for a minimum of 3 years. Check out this statistic. In Baghdad right now, Blackwater has two-thirds as many armed operatives as the United States State Department has in every nation on Earth combined. That's how deeply embedded they are in the occupation. Obama says he wants to increase diplomatic activity in Iraq. Who guards the diplomats in Iraq? It's 100% performed by private for-profit war corporations, Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and DynCorp. When you talk to the U.S. State Department, they say even if we had an incredibly radical increase in funding of the State Department security budget, it would take a minimum of 3 years to recruit, train, vet, and deploy a force of Blackwater's magnitude in Iraq. And then they still would be competing on the open market with for-profit corporations that can pay salaries that are equivalent or greater to that of General David Petraeus, the commanding general of the Iraq occupation. And so Obama has painted himself into a corner with his Iraq plan because he is going to find himself using forces he himself has called unaccountable, above the law, and a danger to U.S. troops. Now, I'm not telling you this in an effort to sort of, you know, smash down Obama. Most of my best friends are in love with Barack Obama. I'm not, they've guzzled the Kool-Aid. I am not trying to break off anyone's engagement to Barack Obama. I'm just trying to get people to cheat on Barack Obama with a little bit of conscience on the war and other foreign policy issues, because now is the time when it actually matters. If he wins in November, he doesn't need anybody anymore to go into those stadiums or do anything. Now is the time when it matters. And I can assure you there is a debate raging at the highest levels of his campaign over his Iraq policy. I don't know if you've been following this, but over the last month, we have seen a pushing aside of more of the progressive foreign policy advisors and a reintroduction of the old guard pro-war advisors from the Clinton era. Madeleine Albright is now on Obama's team. Warren Christopher, Lee Hamilton, Anthony Lake. You know, these were some of the main people responsible for these very, very violent policies during the Clinton administration. The old guard is now in power in the Obama foreign policy team, and this is very ominous. Obama also has a plan to send 7,000 more troops immediately into Afghanistan. That will be good for these companies. And he embraces the rhetoric of the so-called war on drugs in regards to Latin America. You know, this is actually a phrase, war on drugs, that really means counterinsurgency. And Blackwater is looking beyond just the Iraq presence. Blackwater has two major initiatives that it's undertaken that indicate that the company believes it's going to be around for a very, very long time. And I agree with them. I think they will be fine no matter who sits in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Number one, Blackwater recently started a private intelligence company, a private CIA called Total Intelligence Solutions. It's being run by three veterans of the CIA, not from 20 years ago, from the Bush administration. It's headed by 28-year veteran of the CIA, Kofor Black. He was the man who ran the counterterrorism center on 9/11, was in charge of the CIA's extraordinary rendition program, the guy who, which is the government-sanctioned kidnap and torture program, the guy who told the Congress there's a before 9/11 and an after 9/11, and after 9/11 the gloves come off. He was at the center of some of the most violent policies after 9/11. Number two, Robert Richer, former deputy director of operations at Central Intelligence. And number three, and I think he's particularly disturbing, he in black, is Enrique Rick Prado, 24 years in the CIA, 10 in the paramilitary division of the CIA, and an expert in Latin America. What we are seeing now is Blackwater putting on the open market services that they are pushing to Fortune 500 corporations and governments. And what they say in their literature is that we will bring CIA-type services to the corporate boardroom. You now have the careers of some veteran spies, people that were at the center of some of the most sensitive U.S. intelligence operations with an extensive knowledge of U.S. intelligence, networks, contacts. Their entire careers are now on the open market for bidding from for-profit corporations or foreign governments. 70% of the U.S. national intelligence budget, 70%, is outsourced to private contractors right now. This is if I were a traditional conservative in this country, this would have me up in arms. Their primary reason for being is profits, and they are now working on the most sensitive intelligence issues in the United States every single day. The second project of Blackwater relates to Latin America. They are bidding for a share of a $15 billion contract to fight the so-called war on drugs. And the phrasing of it is to fight terrorists with drug trade ties. I researched this program, which the Wall Street Journal says could be Blackwater's biggest job ever. This is a program that specifically targets Bolivia, Colombia, as well as nations in Central Asia and in Afghanistan, where Blackwater already works for the Drug Enforcement Agency. So Blackwater is now creating what its owner, Eric Prince, calls a full-spectrum operation. They're making their own armored vehicles called the Grizzly, which they're trying to get licensed for use on U.S. highways. They're manufacturing surveillance blimps that they're pushing to the Department of Homeland Security to monitor the U.S.-Mexico border. They recently opened a warfare training center in San Diego, three blocks from the Tijuana International Airport in Mexico. They have another facility in Illinois. They're trying to open one in Idaho. They've been deployed in the United States in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, where they sent in their men with M4 assault rifles and Glock 9s onto the streets of a U.S. city, pulling in $240,000 a day in U.S. government contracts. But initially, they just decided to send their men onto the streets with no contract. How is that legal in this country, to send men with weapons and a Puma helicopter onto the streets of a U.S. city and talk about, as they did to me on the record when I was there, we're here to confront criminals and stop looters? And so Blackwater has done in the last 10 years of its existence something that's quite incredible. They have built up a parallel infrastructure to the U.S. national security apparatus. And this is just one company in a sea of them now. Blackwater is like a high-end boutique on a strip full of Walmarts. It's actually one of the smaller companies, but it has incredible proximity to the throne in this country. So I want to wrap up here, and I'm very much looking forward to what Anthony is going to say. But I want to end by saying this, that I think that this really isn't about liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican when it boils down to it. It ultimately comes down to what kind of a country do we want to live in. You see, I was asked in New York about a month ago when we did the initial event for this book if I thought these guys would ever be engaged, would ever want to engage in a coup. You know, these private companies. And, you know, would that we had a leader in Washington that they would think they had to overthrow. And the reality is it ain't Barack Obama. They're going to be fine under Barack Obama. But the fact is, I don't know how many of you have seen that movie, The Usual Suspects. There's a line at the end where Kevin Spacey's character delivers, where he says, "The greatest trick that the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist." In a way, the coup already has happened. We're a pacified society. Many people now are forced to struggle to make ends meet. Gas is well over $4, in some places is nearing $5. We had the predatory lending scandal, the home foreclosure crisis. The economy is horrible. People are struggling to make ends meet. And when you're in that fight for your family, it's hard to pay attention to other things. We have an infotainment media culture and a very pacified public. And so the kinds of fanciful scenarios that people envision are totally unnecessary. The corporations are winning. We live in a corporatist society right now. Every day the government is hollowed out more, public institutions are hollowed out more, and the corporations become more and more prominent. And so my challenge, or the challenge that I think all of us face as we move forward, is not about electoral politics. The moment you cede your conscience to one man or one woman or one politician is the moment you stop engaging in the fight, when you totally put it on someone else. It's much bigger than the elections. The war is still going to be there. The war at home is still going to be there. The paramilitarization of law enforcement is still going to be there. Afghanistan and Iraq are going to continue to burn. The corporations are going to continue to have power. What all of us need to realize is that it is local, it's national, and it's international, but all of us have a responsibility to confront it in our local community. And it's not just about the war. It's about education. It's about public utilities. It's about water. It's a radical privatization agenda that we need to face down against. And so I think all of our challenge is to rise up in whatever way we see fit in our community, to struggle, because ultimately it's fighting for those who live on the other side of the barrel of the gun, and it's fighting for the future of our country. Thank you very much. Thank you. I now have the great pleasure of bringing up one of the great rebel journalists of our time, my friend and colleague Anthony LaPay of the Guerrilla News Network.
Do you want to help me get this? Just need to turn it on. Thanks a lot. It's a real pleasure to be here in Philadelphia. If it wasn't for Philadelphia, actually, I wouldn't exist. My mother, maybe some of you know her work, was a social worker here when she met my father, who was a graduate student at University of Pennsylvania. So very happy to be here in Philadelphia. We're going to switch gears a little bit. I thought I was going to be kind of the warm-up act here tonight, so we kind of flipped it around. You got the heavy stuff first. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my new book, which is called Shooting War, which is a satirical graphic novel based in Iraq, and kind of hits on a lot of themes that Jeremy talks about. Jeremy opened up with a hangover anecdote. I'm gonna one him up him on one. I'm gonna get to that in a minute. It's a little out of order with my the way I've set up my presentation here. Some of you may know me. I'm the editor of the Guerrilla News Network's website, GNN.TV. We've been around since 2000. We are a sort of open source blogger network now, and as well as a television production company. We've produced two feature documentaries. One was called American Blackout. It was about the disenfranchisement of African-American voters, which won a special jury prize at Sundance, and we couldn't get any distribution for it, funny enough. And we also did a documentary, and this is the one I produced with my partner Stephen Marshall, Battleground, 21 Days on the Empire's Edge. We're able to sell this to Showtime, and you can see it on Showtime on demand or rent it or buy it through Amazon or Netflix, etc. Stephen and I were in Iraq in really in the early part of the insurgency, about 6 months after the invasion. And what we saw were really all of the early signs of what was to come, and that was what our film was about. Shortly after I got back, GNN also produced a music video for an artist some of you may know named Eminem. And it was his big breakout political statement. It came out about 2 weeks before the 2004 presidential elections, and it was called Mosh. And it was it used, as you can see, real footage of Eminem rapping against a backdrop of a computer-generated backdrop. And it had a really big impact. It was his kind of get out the vote anti-George Bush statement, and a lot of kids. It was number one on MTV on TRL for about 5 weeks, and it was at least in the press credited with getting a lot of people, a lot of young people motivated to get out to vote. And it was with those two projects, the Battleground film that I did, being on the ground in Iraq, and this project, that I began my mind to think about doing something new and different, kind of breaking. I'd been an investigative and politically sort of charged journalist for the last 15 years, and I was getting, actually, to tell you the truth, a little bit burnt out. You know, the experience of working on American Blackout, winning an award at Sundance, being on top of the world, and then not even being able to get theatrical or television distribution. We ended up selling it to the One Network, which is a new African-American network, but really no one saw it, and that was a couple years later. So it's very frustrating. Jeremy is very lucky, and because he's one of the best journalists I know, he has a backing of the Nation and the Nation Institute and others. I found myself really just getting burnt out being a journalist. I was getting very frustrated. This is another scene from Mosh, and I started to think about doing something more artistic, more darkly satirical. One of the other things I started getting frustrated with journalism, but I also started getting frustrated with the limitations of what you're able to do in the form of journalism. You know, listening to Jeremy talk, I mean, some of the things that he's saying, the investigation of Blackwater being conducted by people who... Okay. Being conducted by people or being guarded by Blackwater. I mean, that's straight out of Joseph Heller. You know, you can't make that up. So I started thinking back to some of the two great films that inspired me that I loved. Apocalypse Now, which for a lot of people, you know, is not a comedy, but for me it is. And, of course, Dr. Strangelove. You know, what I loved about those two films is that, you know, a lot of people, especially people in my generation, thought, Dr. Strangelove is a kind of cartoonish character. Of course, some of you, maybe a little bit older, know that there were a lot of people in the various administrations in the post-war era who believed we could survive a nuclear exchange with Russia and start a new society, possibly underground. That was, that I always loved that movie. So I came back and I decided, and this is where the drinking comes in. I was 3 in the morning. I had this idea. I was telling a friend of mine about it, to write a screenplay, actually, a movie set in the near future about a journalist who goes to Iraq. And as we were drinking more, he said, "You know what, man? That would make a great comic." And I said, "Really? Because I don't really read comics. I don't know anything about them. How would I do that?" And he said, "No, really, it sounds like a great graphic novel." And I said, "Well, how would I ever go about, selling a comic book or a graphic novel when I have no experience doing that?" And he said, "Well, you know, there's this new thing of people doing graphic novels online." So I put, as almost every great project today starts, I put an ad up on Craigslist. And I found a great artist, and we created this story, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about. This, we launched it on a website called Smith Magazine the summer of, 2008? It was in 2006. Yeah, thanks. 2006 when we first started it. And it was basically like a kind of comic that you all kind of grew up reading. It was a serialized, this was not weekly, but bi-weekly, a bi-weekly serialized comic. We put up a new chapter each week. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the story. It's a story of a young, politically radical, video journalist who lives in, Brooklyn. And Williamsburg, to be specific, which is kind of the hip part of Brooklyn. He's, like most bloggers, thinks he's got it all figured out, thinks he knows all the answers. And he's doing he has a 39-part series called The Corporate Takeover of America, and he's doing a video rant in the near future. We're in the year 2011. You're able to upload HD quality video live to your website. It's very cool. You'll be very excited when you get this. So he's doing his live rant in front of a Starbucks that has moved in below him, and he's complaining about how it kicked out the Puerto Rican deli that was there. And all of a sudden, a suicide bomber blows up the Starbucks. Don't clap. That's not right. Though, the news today, Starbucks is closing down 680 Starbucks around the country. 10 of them are on my block. A suicide bomber blows up the Starbucks, and Jimmy Burns, that's his name, has the only footage. And a new news network I created called Global News uploads the footage, and he becomes a sort of, invites him on, and he becomes, to talk about what happened, and he becomes a sort of overnight media superstar. Now, part of what the fun about this book was for me was it was sort of this big thought experiment, and I'm going to take you through some of the things that I kind of came up with. The idea behind it was to think about, you know, where things are headed, both in the media and politically, and where we're going to be in 2011. It's a lot closer to 2011 now than it was when I was writing this, and a lot of things kind of eerily started coming true. I don't know if I'm some sort of savant. I'm more like an idiot savant, I think. But I'm going to take you through some of those things. So the idea behind Global News is sort of a post-Fox News network. And I came up with this in 2006. That the idea is that in 2008, when the Bush administration kind of slunks into the, off to the golf course, Fox News ratings will tank. Of course, they're starting to do that now, which interestingly. But this gives rise to the possibility of a new news network called Global News. Global News is, their tagline is extreme news. And they're sort of they kind of like realize that a lot of young males out there in the 18 to 34 year old demo are watching a lot of shows on TV like Spike News and all these kind of, Spike TV, where you have all these crazy, police chases and parachute jumps gone wrong and things like that. So what they do is they combine, and they realize that the news doesn't really show you this kind of dramatic, extreme, uncensored video. So they start this new network that shows you all of the ugliness of the world, including really graphic war footage. It's all wrapped within a very Lou Dobbsian, ultra-nationalist kind of idea. If you can read that there, their tagline is eternal vigilance, and it's very much about closing the borders. And so they're kind of very right wing, but they're also very about uncensored, showing the uncensored world. So, and they're owned by Lockheed Martin. So Jimmy Burns goes on. I've also killed Elton John. Sorry if you like Elton John. So Jimmy Burns goes on, and he becomes this media superstar. We use a lot of real, media brands and things people as well as publications. So he goes on, and the next thing he knows, he goes on the air and he kind of rants and raves on this network, and he thinks they're going to, kick him off the air. But the next thing he knows, the network calls him in and they say, you know what, kid, we like your attitude. We want to send you to Iraq. And he's like, really? Wow, that's incredible. That's like kind of my dream, to be a war correspondent. Because what's happening in 2011, and once again, it's another thing that sort of started to come true since I wrote in 2006, is the networks have started to pull out their correspondents from Iraq. The war is starting to kind of grind down. The president has started to pull out some of the troops, and it's still kind of raging on, but it's, you know, Afghanistan is kind of blowing up, and Nigeria and Venezuela, a bunch of other things are starting to happen around the world. There's a global oil crisis, and Iraq is there, but it's really not worth the investment for the networks because they're not really, no one really cares what's going on. Now, it was really eerie because, as I said, I wrote this in 2006, and I don't know if you've been following the news, but there was a new study that last week that showed, Jeremy, do you remember the number? It was something like the ABC, CBS, and NBC showed a combined, like, 20 minutes or something ridiculous of Iraq news coverage. And CBS News now has officially has no correspondent. The network of Walter Cronkite has no full-time correspondent based in Baghdad today. So in that vacuum, networks are very excited to send cheap young labor like Jimmy Burns over there to cover it. So he gets there, and of course there is one guy still there. This is Dan Rather, is still over there, trying to resurrect his career. He's working for, as he does today, for HDNet, which is owned by Mark Cuban, who, you know, owns the Dallas Mavericks. So Mark Cuban forces him to wear a Dallas Mavericks logo wherever he goes. But Dan is up for the indignity of that. He doesn't care what logo is slapped on him. He just wants to get in the game. And he becomes a sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi-like mentor to the young Jimmy Burns. Now, Burns finds, and this is one of the main also themes of my book, is that being a blogger and sitting on your couch in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and ranting and raving about evil corporations is a lot easier, it turns out, than being a war correspondent. So he finds quickly that he is not really emotionally or psychologically or professionally equipped to be a correspondent in the hell that is Iraq. Part of what, you know, this book is about is sort of making fun of everyone, including myself. There's a lot of Jimmy Burns in me and a lot of me and Jimmy Burns. One of the other thought experiments I kind of did was, okay, what is the new kind of post-Al-Qaeda threat going to look like or could look like or be funny to look like? So I thought that, you know, what is the most dangerous thing that the Islamic militant threat could sort of morph into in the near future? And the idea I came up with is that, you know, actually the bin Laden brand of jihadist, fervor is actually not very popular in the Muslim world. I mean, even in Pakistan, the political parties that represent, you know, that are supported by Al-Qaeda represent a very small fraction, like 3 or 5%, something like that, of the populace. You know, most young people, if you travel around the Middle East, you know, I was just over in Lebanon myself, you know, most people actually, young Arabs and Muslims, really are, you know, don't want to be able to look at a woman's ankle. They don't want to get their hands cut off. They want to fly kites, etc. So I came up with the idea that, you know, what if there was this new jihadist leader who styled himself as a little hipper, that used the technology that we have today to appeal to the younger generation of Muslims around the world. So I thought of this new character. His name is Abu Abdallah. And he has come up with a new, a free downloadable video game called Infidel Massacre. That's sort of like Grand Theft Auto, but you can download it. And this is actually, it's sort of actually kind of meta comment because, the U.S. military, it has their own free downloadable game that you can play to learn how to kill people and get you fired up to join the military. So he kind of does the same thing. So Burns ends up sort of becoming a pawn between this new jihadist leader who set up shop in Iraq and the commander of a special forces unit who's tasked with tracking him down. Now, ironically, the one criticism, I've gotten a couple of criticism, you know, different places about this book, but one of the criticisms I've got about has been about this character. His name is, nickname is Crash, Lieutenant Colonel Crash. And a lot of people, he's a kind of Bible-thumping lieutenant colonel who's kind of got free range to do whatever he wants in Iraq to track down this jihadist leader. And a lot of people say, well, it's so over the top, you know, that he's kind of uses his Christian iconography and et cetera. And the irony is this guy is the one guy who's actually based upon a real person, a lieutenant colonel that I was embedded it with in Iraq named Lieutenant Colonel Nate Sassaman. I don't know if you guys have heard this guy's story. It sort of kind of ties in with the Blackwater very reminiscent of the Eric Prince. He was actually sort of the original Pat Tillman. He was the quarterback at West Point and turned down the possibility of an NFL career to go into the military, and kind of was in a lot of different hot spots, ended up in Iraq, basically in control, was essentially, you know, a warlord, had his own little fiefdom in the very hot area in the beginning of the war north of Baghdad in the so-called Sunni Triangle. And he started kind of going crazy. It was almost a little bit of a Colonel Curtsy, and to reference back to Apocalypse Now, he started going a little nuts, and he couldn't really handle it. He had no training, and he told this to me point blank, you know, running an occupation, being an intermediary between tribes that he had no knowledge of. He spoke no Arabic. He knew absolutely nothing about Iraq or the people there. And he was all of a sudden had to dole out money and solve problems and build schools and fight an insurgency. So he'd be kind of, and then he was, you know, his men were getting mortared every night. And he kind of went nuts, and he at one point rung a town in barbed wire and issued kind of Palestinian-like ID cards for everyone in the town. He also, right before I was there, bulldozed a date palm orchard that someone just, you know, had been taking pot shots at him from the road. So he just bulldozed like 100-year-old date palm trees that sustained this whole village. So that didn't really go over too well with the locals. We ended up being, you know, getting embedded with him and catching him on film. When we came back, this is the quote you may have heard of him. He was right after he rung the town of barbed wire, he was quoted in the New York Times as saying, with a heavy dose of fear and violence and enough money for projects, these people will come to understand we're here to help them. And it sort of became that, you know, we had to destroy the village to save them, quote, of the early part of the war. Anyway, to make a long story short about my old man, my buddy Sassaman here, he came back from Iraq and went on the lecture circuit mostly in churches around the country, giving a lecture called The Christian Warrior Ethic. And his lecture circuit tour was cut short because it came out that two of his men had one day, while he under his command, took two Iraqi teenagers and for fun threw two of them off a bridge into the Tigris and kind of laughed as one of them drowned. And Sassaman basically told the guys to cover up the incident. And he only got off, once again, this is, you know, here's military justice. When they investigated, Sassaman got off with a slap on the wrist for, you know, and it was great. If you read there's a big New York Times Magazine article about him. If you read that article, it says the euphemism is Sassaman was charged with was accused of telling his men to leave out certain details in the incident. Well, those certain details were the fact that they threw him off the bridge and murdered them. Anyway, so he's sort of based upon a real character, and he become our hero. Jimmy Burns becomes embroiled in a sort of cat and mouse game between them, the lieutenant colonel and Abu Abdallah. These are some of the screens. What we tried to do is, you know, create this next generation of news in this kind of hyper nationalist kind of Fox News on steroids. And what it does, we also try to look at how one of the big questions I raise is not only sort of critiquing the blogging culture and the insular kind of know-it-allness, but also trying to predict how, and I'm not going to give away sort of the plot line here, but how citizen media and people using their own things like YouTube might actually have an effect in the future on coverage of a war zone. So that's the story. I'm going to quickly show you guys before, and we're going to go to a Q&A after I'm done. For those of you who are into graphic novels or the art aspect of what we did here, my artist, Dan Goldman, created this whole thing completely digitally using Photoshop. Ironically, most of the military tech, the hardware and backgrounds we used were really conveniently provided to us by the State Department and the Department of Defense's public affairs websites, where you can download high-res photos from the Defense Department of all the great things that they're doing in Iraq. So we use all those things to, you know, in the true nature, I told you I'm from the Guerrilla News Network, as a guerrilla, to use the enemy's weapons against them. We used their own images to create this storyline. So he would create all this, and I'm just going to quickly show you how these things are built digitally, paints them in, creates shadows. Another one of the interesting things that are kind of scary things that I thought of was that the military was going to, in addition to using contractors, also start, you know, because they don't have a lot of young men aren't really very excited anymore about being deployed to Iraq, we're going to start using ground-based offensive robots. Now, that was another thing when I came up with that. People were like, "Yeah, that's so sci-fi. This is only 2011. There's not going to be any robots with guns going around." Well, there are. This is actually this is a little bit more of a souped up version of a real thing called the Talon, which is a ground-based offensive robot with a very big gun on it. The joke I make in the book is that because they can't get kids to enlist in the Army anymore, they bring them to a hangar, all these kind of PS3 jacked up kids, they bring them to a hangar in Florida and have them controlling them totally virtually, fighting the war from a hangar in Florida. And of course that raises all sorts of human rights issues when things go badly, and that's one of the things that happens in the book. Some other images here. One of the things, sorry, I didn't have an image of, is of course, John McCain is president in 2011 in my book. This was, kind of came up with this really before the presidential season really just started, or hadn't really begun. And so I tried to also imagine what would happen under a McCain presidency. You know, and I sort of picked McCain not because I thought he was going to be president at that time, but really because he, from a literary point of view, has so many incredible sort of dramatic possibilities in terms of his own connection to the war. One of the subplots I came up with is that his son joins the military and goes over to Iraq and is kidnapped and is held hostage, and how that affects him psychologically. Eerily, like 2 weeks after I wrote that into the webcomic, his son joined up with the Marines, which was kind of freaky. I didn't really plan on that. So a lot of weird things. I also, one of the last thing, you know, the big thing that I thought about, the central setup joke I have of the whole book was that McCain, because of the influence of Iran, starts a de-Shiification program of the Iraqi military, trying to get the Iranian influence out, and reforms it into what he calls nationalist forces, which were basically the former Baathists and Sunnis. Of course, a year later after I wrote that, we started the whole so-called Sunni awakening, which is, you know, basically paying off and arming a lot of the guys who had been fighting, you know, in the Baathist element insurgency. So it was another really weird thing that had happened. So that's the story, and I'd love to talk to you guys about it if you have any questions. That's the website, shootingwar.com. You can read about 20% of the, or 30% of the book there, and then it picks up, and the kind of the complete story is told in the book, which is on sale out there. GNN.TV is my website, and activate.com is my artist Dan Goldman's website, where you can read a whole collection of other webcomics if you're interested in that. So with that, I'm going to bring up, I think, Jeremy, and we're going to answer some of your questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, if you have any questions, please raise your hand. We'll get you a mic. Gentleman in the blue there, please wait for the mic.
A question to Jeremy. Blackwater. Somewhere in the back of my imagination, there's the feeling that it was a term invented by the right-wingers as a takeoff and revenge against the Clintons with Whitewater. Any basis for that?
Well, I wrote a column once called From Whitewater to Blackwater because Ken Starr actually has worked for Blackwater as a lawyer, Kenneth Starr, who led the impeachment charge against Clinton. No, I'm sorry to disappoint you, though. The name of the company, Blackwater, actually comes from the dark waters of the Great Dismal Swamp of North Carolina. It was a tip of the hat to the environment there, although it does sound very, very ominous. Blackwater, in fact, tried to, they're lawyers, they have an army of lawyers, when my book first came out, the lawyers were sort of threatening me for Blackwater because they didn't like that my website had the word Blackwater in it. And they were trying to say I violated something called the Lanham Act, which has to do with, like, corporate branding, as though these guys were making cereal, and then I, made a cereal and, spelled it with, with the C missing. I spelled B-L-A-K water or something, or Nike with a C-K. But what was interesting about that is in the course of responding to that, which we had to through our lawyers, we found out that, they don't even own the copyright to the term Blackwater's Black. There's other Blackwater lodges. There's Blackwater River, Blackwater Wildlife Refuge. But, no, we heard this from people that are no longer with the company that were there in the original days of it when they were discussing the name, and it was about the environment. But they couldn't have picked a more ominous-sounding name.
But isn't Blackwater also, what's in your RV at the end of a camping trip? I mean,
what's funny is that when my book came out in Spanish, the translation of Blackwater in Spanish would be Agua Negra, which is sewage.
That's what I mean. It's sewage.
So... although the Spanish publisher decided not to call it Agua Negra, they called it Blackwater. But it does in fact sound very ominous. And Blackwater is a term that is used in some special forces communities to talk about the dark waters right before you make an amphibious landing. But it seems like it's an environmental tip of the hat.
Another question? No, there's got to be another question. Yes, in the second row here.
Jeremy, I feel like I know you. I see you on Amy Goodman all the time. You started to talk at the end of your talk about what we as citizens can do, and you talked about an agenda of privatization. Could you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that we have to recognize that we are right now in this country in the midst of, hands down, the most radical privatization agenda in our history. It cuts across every possible line of society. And I was just at a major conference of all these groups that are organizing against the war. And you hear a lot of people talking about the need for national mobilizations and to go into the streets and to be in Washington, D.C. And I think in a way, I was really glad to see what Anthony is doing, because I think we need to start thinking outside of the box in what we're doing. And right now, I think creative media is very important. I think finding a way to culturally reach out to younger folks in this country and to be able to speak in the language that's being used in the culture is extremely important. A lot of the rhetoric of the anti-war movement is so outdated that it's embarrassing to be a part of it at times, because we see the a lot of what's happened with the, and I'm sure Anthony would have thoughts on this, a lot of what's happened with the Obama campaign is you've had some very creative, first of all, Obama has an automatic appeal to a lot of young people just on the surface, as it is, the way he speaks, the fact that he's young, but also you've seen this sort of viral web campaign of a lot of pop figures that have really helped to give him credibility in a broader community as well. On this issue, though, what I'm saying is that it's not just about sort of standing with a sign that says no to war or, end all wars, which you see that still to this day. The point is that the corporations are now more powerful than the war machine itself. And so it's a matter of taking it directly to the corporations. And so we've seen some really great actions in recent months against Blackwater, in particular in San Diego, where they've been really fighting to try to keep the facility that they opened up and running. They got defeated by a town of 850 people when they attempted to set up an 800-acre private military base on the U.S. border with Mexico, right near Tecate, Mexico. And that had to do with a wide cross-section of groups and individuals working on it. But what I concretely think we all need to be looking at is what war corporations are in our community. Or what corporations are leading a privatization agenda in our community, and what's the voting record of the politicians that represent these districts where we see this radical shift of public monies to the private sector? I feel like the corporations have just been, they've gotten off totally scot-free from any form of effective protest. Yes, sometimes people protest at Bechtel or KBR or whatever, but I think it's a matter of really shifting gears and looking at the not just government institutions, but the corporations, which in many instances are dwarfing governmental-type operations. Because it used to be that corporations had a tremendous influence over policy. Now the corporations dictate it and actually, as we see in Iraq, implement it. So I think that there needs to be discussion of local justice groups about how to reach out to younger people and communicate with younger folks in a language and a cause they can understand, but also addressing the corporations in these individual communities. I mean, I'd be interested because Anthony is a great example of someone whose work has a great cross appeal, across a generational, across generational boundaries. And what you think of this also?
Yeah, I mean, stepping back, one of the reasons I did this also as a comic book, not just because of my own personal artistic inclinations, but also it was just, it is another venue. We had at GNN been working in lots of different genres, from music videos to documentaries, and one of the frustrating things of working in documentaries now, I mean, nobody wants to watch a documentary about Iraq. What my ideas behind going into making a comic book was, you can really reach and get very subversive ideas to people, especially younger kids, who are open to getting information in different ways. So that was one of the reasons that my motivations for going into doing a comic book, and now actually I'm trying to develop it into a TV series with a company in London, which will probably, if we, sell it, it will probably start over in the UK, but hopefully may end up here on, say, something like a sci-fi network is what we're looking at pitching it to. So, that was really, one of my main, but I absolutely agree. One of the interesting things, I mean, when you, reading things like Smedley Butler, if you guys know who he was, a general who wrote this incredible book called The War is a Racket, where he literally says, I was a henchman for, United Fruit, in Latin America. You have what Obama is facing now is an inertia of all of these contracts and just the construction alone. I mean, when you see how big our, massive green zone and also the embassy that's in there and how much actual stuff, I mean, the bases that I was on, the Anaconda, which is the main base in the Sunni Triangle, I mean, it is a small city. We have small cities now in Iraq, and I think I remember you saying on Bill Maher, I mean, aren't they there? I mean, Obama now is committed to keeping up to what, like 50, 40?
It's 20, about 20 to 80, because
bases. Hasn't he also been saying that they're willing to keep some forward operating bases outside of the green zone?
Yeah, I mean, Obama is saying publicly that they're not going to have any permanent military bases in Iraq. But the problem is that his plan necessitates keeping a long-term control over several military installations in Iraq. Right. So that was the point.
Just a quick point on that. I mean, and that is the ultimate paradox of Iraq is, one of the interesting things that a lot of people don't really realize about Donald Rumsfeld is Rumsfeld, at the end of his reign, was trying to figure out ways to ramp down the occupation, and that meant he started trying to close down some of the smaller operating bases and keep people making what he called a small footprint and doing just kind of drive-by patrols and not pulling guys off from getting on the roads. And what happened is that we got creamed. The American troops started getting blown up. And that is the ultimate paradox that Obama is facing, is that you, in an occupation like that, if you don't control the cities, you can't just be there without getting creamed and getting, so you can't half pull out. You have to either pull out or you have to keep, you know, the pressure on the insurgents and drive them out of cities like they, you know, they've been trying to do. At least that's my strategy. I'm not a military analyst, but that's essentially the lessons that we've been learning. So I'm getting off topic, but that's, you know, one of the problems with Obama plan, in my opinion.
A few more questions. Gentleman in the yellow, about five rows back here with his hand up. Give me a microphone.
The discussion so far has...
Can you hold the mic closer to you?
Yeah, the discussion so far has dealt directly with things like Blackwater and so on. And the question that the community wants to know is, how do you defeat that? And it would seem to me that if you cut off their funds, that you do that. And how is it that you cut off their funds? You change the tax system in the United States, which supplies the funds. You require the government to provide for the needs of the people, and you just take all the money away from these structures, which now take billions and billions of dollars. Now, unless you see it as a totality, you're never going to get rid of these characters unless somehow you take the money away from them.
Well, I mean, you're giving a theoretical solution to this. I mean, the fact is that we would need over 400 different people in the U.S. Congress to even remotely consider what you're talking about. I mean, if what you're asking, what can we actually do about it, or what should be done? I'm sure everyone in this room has an idea of what should be done. If we were the emperor of the United States, we could just, you know, issue an edict that says, make it so. The fact is that Nancy Pelosi, the crowning achievement of Nancy Pelosi's time in the Congress, is to get an approval rating lower than that of President Bush, which she had to work really hard to attain that. Let's be clear. Obama is a party player. Obama is absolutely going to have the backing of big corporate America because he's going to defend their interests. He will make some marginal changes. He is not going to do anything to bring down this system. If he was going to, he would not be the Democratic nominee for president. There's no question about it. He would not be embraced by the Democratic power structure. He wouldn't be getting the kind of corporate money that he's getting. You know, I mean, the problem, the risk here, I think, is people are going to get their hopes up and think Obama is going to come in and just overnight, or in one term, or even in two terms, radically change what is a fact about this country. That we have one political party that defends corporate interests. And Obama is a member of that party. He's now a leader of that party. And it's you know, Obama is not some kind of a radical socialist. As much as they want to try to make him out to be on the right, Obama is, he said the other day, I'm a free market guy. I love the market. He's going to defend it like someone who's in love with it. And there's no question. He's not, it's an illusion that Obama is going to bring radical change to the fundamental fact of the, that there is a corporatist system in this country. I don't know if Anthony has something to say about it.
Yep.
Folks, we have time for one more question. Lady right in the front row here in the green.
Hey, Jessica Clark. I'm with In These Times magazine. I was sort of intrigued by the pairing and then the comments that both of you had about the media system. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether...
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.